was awesome. Back when I was an idiot, when I was first applying to Pew for a grant to do research about, you know, the role of technology in people's lives, I one of the parts of the grant proposal that I wrote was who would be the stakeholders for the information. I wrote a section on what the competitive landscape looked like, who was doing work like this, and I also wrote a section about who might profit from this information. And the idiot version of me didn't put librarians at the top of the list. But after we did our first piece of work in March of 2000, I quickly learned that the library community was the primary group of stakeholders for our work. And at every of the six now grant proposals I've written to Pew, you guys are at the top of the list. Our motto at the Pew Internet Project is, every day spent with librarians is a better day. And I said at an ALA conference recently, or actually the Computers and Libraries conference, our action plan is wherever two or more librarians are gathered, we want to be there. So this is an awesome hit for me. You heard us self-described as a fact tank. That's a deliberate way that we distinguish ourselves from another part of the Washington bestiary, think tanks, because we actually are prohibited under the terms of the money that we get from the Pew Charitable Trusts from advocating for anything. We are strictly about primary research and primary information, but we don't have an agenda driving our work. We don't advocate for policies. There's no Pew Internet position on net neutrality or anything like that. We're just in the business of providing research and information that we hope is useful to lots of people like you guys, but we don't tell you how to use it, and we don't tell you what it means for your lives, because we figure you guys can do that well enough for yourselves. The other thing that's really awesome about this is that I used to be in journalism. I used to be a print reporter and a magazine editor, and I have no detectable belief system, so it's like a perfect marriage of a man and a mission. The Pew, you know, is not an acronym. It's a family name. It's a guy who found oil in Pennsylvania in the late 19th century, drilled a lot of it, shipped a lot of it, made a lot of money for it. It's the Sun Oil, or now Sunoco, fortune. And his children and grandchildren, now great-grandchildren, have created this wonderful philanthropy that gives money to people like me. And the guy who created it, the son of the founder, of the creator of the fortune, was Joseph N. Pew. And he talked about philanthropy, at least in his version of it, as being organized around telling the truth and trusting the people. And that's the sort of spirit that animates our work, which is also awesome, too. But I do advocate for one thing. I break all the Pew rules to advocate for one thing. I want the Oxford English Dictionary to embrace the word tweckle. It's a transitive verb, as you can see. It was coined by the Chronicle of Higher Education. It's to heckle someone on Twitter. Okay? And the Chronicle wrote a piece about this for academics who give speeches at academic conferences. And it had real tweets in it of people who didn't do so well with audiences as a warning that this was happening even as they were speaking. And that when the ones they cited in this piece were, these are real tweets. We need a T-shirt. I survived the keynote disaster of 09. It's awesome, and I don't want to turn away from the accident because I might see a severed headway. And my particular favorite, too bad they took my utensils away with my plate. I could have jammed the butter knife into my temple. So use the hashtag. You guys aren't using it very much now. It's MLSMC13. But don't twackle me, because my staff stalks me as I speak. They watch how I'm speaking, and I hear no end of grief if people actually say I stink or something like that, or I'm an idiot or something like that. I'm so glad to be in Massachusetts, because as you can tell, I'm a native Northeasterner. I'm a New Yorker by birth. I speak at a speed that you guys can appreciate, but no one below the Mason-Dixon line can. And so I'm glad we don't have to do simultaneous translation of me. And yet I know I just spout and spout and spout. So one of the ways I stop myself is to invite questions as we go along. You guys came here because you are interested in reinventing yourselves and change and stuff like that. I'd much rather answer your questions then lecture at you. So please raise your hand as the spirit moves if you want me to elaborate something, or if I've left something out that really matters to you, or if you've want me to dive more deeply into something that I've only glanced over, please do that. And I will stop every once in a while, because the other bad feature of my speaking style is I was born in New York, but I now live in Washington. So I went to all the re-education camps where you have to learn, filibustering and just going on and on and on and on and on, especially when you have data full of your head. So I glanced over my title slide really quickly, but there are seven questions I want to talk about that can orient your work, both as you think about your role in your lives and as you work with your staffs to reinvent yourselves and to organize change in your life. I don't have the playbook for this. I can organize the questions pretty well, but in some respects, these are questions you have to answer to taste in your institution and in your community. There's not a one-size-fits-all playbook. If there were, I would have invented it, and I would not be working for a .org. But these are the ways that you should talk to yourselves, I think, and think about the meaning of what you're already experiencing, but also some of the data that I will later be sharing. So question number one is, what's the future of knowledge? Obviously, the mechanisms of knowledge and the dissemination of knowledge are changing. What's the future of reference expertise? You get this question a lot. I'm sure you hear it from your stakeholders. In the era of powerful search engines, what do you do that's really, really important and valuable? What's the future of public technology? One of the most striking things that you'll see in our data is that libraries have reinvented themselves already as technology hubs for their communities. Well, in many cases, people depend on or are very fond of the technology provision that you give them. And so there's a special way that you address digital divides and that you serve the needs of your communities with the technology that you've added. What's the future of learning spaces? The four C's were already referred to. Now, obviously, there are new ways that people come together and learn stuff. There's a much more obvious social dimension to the way that people get together and create things and innovate. So that's a big change. What's the future of community anchor institutions? One of the lovely notions that really has come to prominence in the past decade is you guys are at the center of your communities. And you serve a special role in the information architecture of your communities and meeting the particular information needs of your communities. But the role is changing as more and more institutions get into the business of providing information, being curators and archivists of information and stuff like that. So where do you fit in that ecosystem? The big question is, what's the franchise? What do you guys do? And this is a real particular community answer or institutional answer that's different community by community. What do you do that's incredibly valuable and that only you bring the greatest value to? There are probably, yeah, and then you have to answer a second question related to that. What's the commodity? So what do you do that's really great that you need to lavish resources on because the world depends on you and you're really great at it? And what's the other stuff that other people do that you want to point them to, but you don't necessarily have to feel that you have to own it and you have to curate it and you have to do special things? So how can you strike a balance between those things? And that gets me to question number seven, which is a refinement I've made of a really wonderful piece of work that the American Library Association did. They essentially laid out a dashboard with points on a spectrum about where libraries should talk to themselves and talk to their stakeholders and patrons about where they fit. The first axis was how much of your stuff is physical, facilities and media, at one end of the spectrum, and how much of it is virtual. There's not a single answer to that, but you have to figure out where you stand as you answer those other questions, where you stand on this dashboard. The second axis is how much of it is individually focused. You're meeting the needs of individual patrons, and how much of it is community focused. There's a varying bunch of ideas that you can fit along that. The third axis is how much are you a collection library and how much are you a curation library. There's so much more urgency now and interest now in the maker side, the social side of libraries. I know that every library that's going through a strategic review, either in a formal or informal sense, is thinking, what do we do with community spaces? Where do we fit? How do we serve our patrons this way? Well, you know, that means sometimes that the stacks have to be moved and books might have to be less visible than they were. That's a hard choice to make, and you've got to make it. How much are we a portal and how much are we an archive? In other words, how much do we pass through and point people to information and how much of it do we store ourselves and make available? And the one that I've added, those four were already on the ALA list. The fifth one I've added is, and it reflects what I hear a lot from librarians, that their real struggle is, you know, the traditional library has always tried to serve people in a way that is every possible way that you can serve them, you try to serve them. So it's everything for everyone. You know, there are lots of different ways that people connect to your institutions, and you want to make sure that you've met almost all the needs you can. And how much of it do you have to, in this era of hard choices and new services and things like that, how much do you have to think of yourself as sort of a niche enterprise where you're really serving particularly important or particularly useful or particularly relevant folks at the expense of maybe not doing the same stuff for the entirety of your patrons? It's hard stuff. I don't have the playbook, but welcome to the world of pain that every other institution that talks to Pew Internet wants to know about. I hear from government agencies every day. I hear from big nonprofits every day. The media community itself, you know, the for-profit or the less for-profit now than it used to be, media community. All kinds of media companies, record companies, movie companies, obviously book publishers and stuff. They are asking and wrestling with the same questions that you guys are. So it's, the circle of pain is large, and nobody has yet figured out how to, you know, get to nirvana. So you guys could be there first. Any questions about that? Who I am, what Pew is, what the sort of organizing thrust of my talk is? I've lost you already. Excellent. You might have noticed that in the past 2 years, we have done particularly focused research about libraries and about the state of reading. And we've done that because we have a wonderful grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that required that we do particular research on libraries. The most immediate thing we did was very late last year, and then we've been rolling out a series of reports, and we have one more report to go about library services. We've asked folks about the role of libraries in their communities, the role of library in their lives, what they would like their libraries to do, what they themselves would do if new services were added. So I'm going to go through a lot of those data, but the starting point is, and probably the starting point for you and lots of the conversations that you have with your stakeholders and the people that you want to love you, is that you are in great shape on the fundamentals. The first thing is libraries are appreciated. In our data, 91% of the adult respondents in our survey, and these are big, nationally representative surveys. This is meant to represent the entire population of the United States age 16 and older. This isn't just a convenience sample. This isn't, you know, a simple thing that you just talking to people on the street that you encounter. These are representative of the whole country. 91% of people aged 16 and older say the library is important to their community. 76% say it's important for them and their families. Now, those are great numbers to begin with for libraries, but what's striking to me in those numbers is that the community answer is greater than the personal answer. And what's going on in that answer is that people, even if they don't necessarily go to libraries a lot, or even if they haven't necessarily thought about their libraries a lot in the recent past, it's important for their community. They feel like it's a significant sign of who they are as a place if they have a good local library. And they want the library to be out there and available to people who may not have the same advantages and the same resources that they do as they have information needs, as they're getting media, as they're organizing their meetings and stuff. So it's a real mark of pride for people that their library in town be there, serve its patrons well, and serve the wider community well. The second thing is, when I presented those first data, the immediate question that I hadn't thought to answer, but now I have an answer, is, okay, they love us, but how does that make us compare to other institutions? Pew asks a lot of questions about confidence in institutions and stuff like that, but even more regular work is done by the Gallup polling organization, which asks a question about how confident are you in these institutions to do what they're expected to do. And the axis was, are you very confident or extremely confident, very confident, somewhat confident, not too confident, and stuff like that. And so you can see, well, maybe not, but you can see at the top of this list, the U.S. military is the one institution whose reputation has actually gone up in the past generation. Every other institution has seen a decline in the number of people who are very confident in it. And if you take this somewhat different question that we asked, how important is the library for your community? Their answer is that it ranks higher, both in extreme importance as well as it's very important, than any other institution. The one other place that I know there's been some wonderful research by the OCLC, it finds that you're competing with firefighters as the most beloved people in your town, right? Not a bad place to be. And so then the question becomes, well, if you're beloved and you outrank many other institutions just in public affection, how come your stakeholders don't know that? And how come they don't reward that? And partly it's tough times. We haven't asked questions about this, but here are the hypotheses that I've heard. It's tough times. Everybody's taking hits in these times, and you're no exception. But the second one is sort of particular to the library community. You guys aren't really loud, squeaky wheels, right, for your stuff. You've done good jobs. You are innovative and creative. You do more with less. So you've taken your hits. You still are performing well, and that distinguishes you in interesting ways from institutions in town that are struggling or problems that aren't being met. And so those are the squeaky claimants for extra resources, and you guys don't necessarily do that great a job at raising your hand and saying, but we're beloved and we do a great job for our patrons too, and we're doing it now with less than we used to have. And the third thing is that librarians are just sort of good at networking. And so one of the hallmarks of the digital age is that networks solve problems. And so you guys do incredibly interesting, and this meeting is a perfect example of it, outreach to talk to each other and learn from each other and to find best practices and to embrace them relatively quickly. As a community, you adopt innovation probably faster than lots of other places. So that's kind of what I think is going on there. The third thing is people love librarians. Almost everybody has great encounters and feels like they have nice things to say about librarians and nice ways to interact with them. These are our data on that. In the past year, about half of the adults in your communities, if you're a typical community, have actually had dealings with you where you helped them solve problems and stuff like that. There's a high correlation between people who have engaged with librarians in the past year and their affection for libraries. If you've served them well and they have a good encounter, it's like good customer service, right? You know, every day is a job interview, and they go out into the community and they talk you up, which is good. Be ready for your close-up because you never know when you're going to have it. And the other thing that's a reality of this, of course, is that for customer service or patron engagement, you're not being compared to other public institutions. You're being compared to Starbucks and Nordstrom and other, high-end retail establishments that are in the customer service business. And so, the playing field has gotten a lot wider in that context. Why not? Those are my three points to start with. Any questions related to those? I'm so upset that you're not asking. Okay, well, really, really good. I'm still telling you about love. Wait till I get to the hard part, and then you can complain. This is the point I made before. You've rebranded yourselves as tech hubs without deliberately setting about to do that and without really sort of, pounding your chests about that. But when we ask people what's really important for libraries to do, there is no statistical significance in any of those four answers. They like the capacity to borrow books from libraries. Never going to change. They like that there are reference librarians that they can consult. It's very important for their communities. But right there with them, even though the numbers are slightly lower, it's statistically insignificant. They say it's important for libraries to provide access to the internet and computers. But then right under that, they send you a completely contradictory message because they say libraries ought to be great and need to cherish quiet study spaces, right? So they want you to be everything. This is the tension in your lives. Nobody that has loved what you've given them in the past wants any of that ever to change, right? And everybody who's under the age of about 40 wants everything to be added to, right? So it's an and world, and lots of other institutions are going through it, but it makes life really hard for you to figure out where your next increment, where your next dollar is going to go, where do you place it, where your next minute of staff time ought to be devoted and things like that, because there are tons of conflicting and additive messages that are embodied in our data. And this is the point where I thought it would make sense just to share our run of data with you just so you know you know, this is what we do day in and day out at the Pew Internet Project. We look at how people use technology. And a question. Awesome. The question is, were these questions asked of everybody? And the answer is yes. Everybody is, this is a survey. So you get 20 minutes of us harassing you on the phone and answering lots of questions about what's important for the library to do for its community, what they would do. So all of these questions that I'm responding, everybody got them. And these are representative of the full population. What we didn't do, though, which is maybe undergirding your question, is we didn't ask them to rank their priorities. People would have a hard time doing that, and the data themselves, and that's really something where different communities will come up with different answers. So relying on nationally representative data is probably not, you know, the one way that you guys can think about, you know, what your market is trying to tell you and things like that. You're going to have to do your own tests. By the way, all of our data are available for free. All our questionnaires are available for free. You can download them. We want you to do them in your own communities if you feel like it. We're happy to share our questionnaires with you. The next piece of research we're going to do is going to be almost pure play market research. We're going to do a typology of library users and non-users because there are different reasons why people engage and why they don't engage. And we're going to, you know, and if you've ever seen sort of classic market segmentation work, that's what we're going to do here. So that we'll have lots of interesting data for you guys to play with after we've bled it dry for our purposes. So here's our technology. Oh, yeah, good. Yes, these are. Yes, thank you for asking that. Are these cell phone interviews as well as regular phone interviews? Now, the Gates work was the first that was done at the wider Pew Research Center, of which I'm a part, where we actually, we increased the cell phone representation in our samples to 50%. During that political season of 2008, it was 33%. Of 2012, it was about 40%. This work is now 50%. So half of our calls are completed on cell phones and half are on landlines. You have to do that in the polling business because now more than a third of the population is cell only. More than half of people under the age of 35 are cell only. More than half of Hispanics are cell only. More than I think it's close to two-thirds of poorer households are cell only. So you, in order to make sure you're talking to a representative sample of the population, you have to use those samples. And the nice thing that happened in the past 5 or 6 years is that the registries of cell owners became as robust as the registries that have been used for three generations on landline polls. So we're very confident that these are good nationally representative data, although response rates are challenged these days, where fewer and fewer people, you know, will answer the phone if they see a strange number on it. Yeah. The 76% have said the library is important to them and their families. We couldn't find previous questions on this. For the Gates work, these are original questions to us, so there are not trend data on that. I'm sorry to report. And so we don't know whether it's going up or going down. Yeah. Okay, so I'll run. This is the idiot savant part of the presentation where I just run through numbers. The revolution that we first saw occurring as we began our work in the year 2000 was broadband at home. About half of Americans already were internet users when we first started asking the question, but nobody had broadband at home. So through the 2000s, when we were doing our work, we saw the broadband revolution unfold before our very eyes. Now two-thirds of adults have broadband at home. It's an amazingly fast-deploying technology, but, you know, you back out that number. A third of Americans don't have broadband at home, and they are really different people, and they have really different information needs and expectations than non-broadband users. The big story, as broadband came into people's homes, they spent more time on the internet, they did more stuff, they watched a lot more video, and they became content creators themselves. They used all of the two-way functionality of the internet, plus the social media tools to share their stories, and to react to things, and to rate things. And to, you know, do all sorts of ways to publish their own findings. And it enormously democratized the media ecosystem. It enormously annoyed people who used to dominate the media system, including people who were in the press and in the record business and stuff like that. But that, you know, that's a big change. The second revolution is the mobile revolution. 91% of American adults have cell phones. About 80% of teenagers have them. Now, for the first time, we reported 2 weeks ago that more than half of Americans have smartphones, 56%. It's about evenly split between Android and iPhones. And we just reported last week that a third of Americans have tablet computers now. A huge change in that market occurred once the Kindle Fire and the Nook came into existence and changed the price point and stuff like that. So it's a really rapidly advancing technology. And everybody who sort of studies the business angle of this says that now more tablets are going to ship and be bought this year than PCs and desktops. You know, so it's a big change going on. These are data from the CTIA, the wireless lobby or the Wireless Trade Association, based in D.C., and it's millions of subscribers, millions of subscriptions. So in 2010, there were 302.9 million subscriptions. At the end of 2012, there are 326.4 million subscriptions. From a social researcher perspective, that is awesome because that's more than the number of human beings in the United States, right? And we are pikers compared to other places. More than 100 countries have more wireless subscriptions than there are human beings, but 7 countries have 2 times the number of wireless subscriptions as the number of bodies in the country. So we're way low compared to Hong Kong, South Korea, a couple of the Scandinavian countries and stuff like that. But it's an amazingly hyper-connected world, particularly with smartphones, as people, you know, have those apps in the phones, and that's changed the media ecosystem for them as well. And the third revolution is the revolution in social networking. Humans have had friends ever since we settled on the Tigris and Euphrates, but when you put them in technology and you reify them so that everybody else can see them, or at least your friends can see them, it changes the way that people think about friendship and think about community and think about interacting with folks. These are age-related data among internet users of people who use social networking sites. Right now, 61% of all adults, including non-internet users, use social networking sites. And 72% of internet users use them. And the number that's down at the bottom on the right here is senior citizens who use the internet. So about 56% of senior citizens use the internet now. 38% of them use social networking sites. So this isn't just the playground of young folks anymore, right? And it's special magic for seniors to go online, and you ought to understand this because if you remember back to the golden days of yesteryear when you filled out your first Facebook portrait, you told where you were born, you told where you lived, you told what schools you went to, you told what businesses you worked for, you told if you felt like it, you told what camps you went to and stuff like that, and Facebook started serving up all the names of people who filled in the same information as you, and did you want to friend them? Well, for folks of a certain age, this is like reinvigorating their entire life, right? It's sort of magical and it's sort of enchanting. And I was telling this to religious broadcasters at the Grand Ole Opry Convention Center in Dallas, in Nashville. And one of the guys in the back of the room stood up and said, "It's just like the resurrection." And I said, "Sir, that is awesome. I'm a social scientist. I felt like calling them restoration of latent ties, but I'm going to call them resurrection ties from here on out." And it's and you can probably see it in your own lives, in your parents' lives, in your community lives. There's a different quality to the conversation. There's a different way of interacting when literally people are restored to relationship with people they probably had forgotten. And they also use social networking sites to solve problems. If you've got a chronic disease or you're a caregiver for someone with a chronic disease, one of the first things you do on Facebook is find communities, often of strangers, but who are going through the same stuff that you are. And that's another part of the magic to them. There's lots of advice about who are the good doctors and where are the good hospitals and what are the good treatments, but it's also really good advice about how to live through this stuff. You know, how to cope and where to get help and how to get through acts of daily living and stuff like that. So there's real sort of special stuff, and it has qualitatively expanded and changed the nature of what happens on social networking sites once the population began to democratize, and it wasn't just college kids. These are horrible slides, but I give them to you so you can take them back to your bosses and say, the Pew guy really says this is happening with nationally representative samples. These are data on who uses a variety of social networking sites. So we ask a generic question, who uses social network sites? And, you know, it's right now, it's people who are under the age of 50 are pretty even, and people who are over 50 are somewhat less likely. We asked specifically about Facebook users, and, you know, not surprisingly, women more than men and things like that. We have Twitter users. Actually, we have brand new Twitter data that says it's 18% of the population now. The important thing to note about Twitter, all of you who are twickling me, is that it's 18%, right? And it's not the 70% who you're using Facebook. So Twitter is really important because they're influencers. They're people who have audiences. They're people who really are connected to their communities. They really pay attention to the news culture and the civic culture of their communities. So they're really important as influencers. But as a population, it's still not that big. And that number hasn't grown a lot in the past 2 years. So it's not, you know, there's so much attention, particularly during the election season, of Twitter this and Twitter that. Great, they're influencers, but it's not everybody. Pinterest now is rivaling Twitter. It's just actually, you know, statistically insignificant number. I want to know how many guys in the room use Pinterest. All right, there are some. And how many women use Pinterest? Yeah, here we go. This is the story in our data too. It's a different kind of experience. Instagram very popular with African Americans and younger folks and somewhat poorer folks, interestingly enough. And then there are some Tumblr numbers in here, too. The fifth point from our data is that reading is alive and well. This whole notion that we've, you know, gone, you know, culturally and universally stupid or uninterested or unengaged is just not true. I mean, 75% of age 16 and older have read a book in the past year. 23% have read an e-book. And that number has grown in the past 2 years as we've been measuring it. Among those book readers, the average or the mean number of books they read is 15 in the past year. The median number, so half above and half below, is 6. So they're obviously heavy-duty book readers, and you guys know them probably pretty intimately. But if you have an e-book reader or you have a tablet computer, you're much more likely to be a book reader in the first place. The whole reason you got the device, in many cases, was to scratch this itch that you can't scratch enough in your life. You're book omnivores, and they don't act like platform snobs. In other words, they don't say, I'm only going to read it on a Kindle or a tablet. I'm never going to read a printed form again. Heck no. They want it in all formats. They are, you know, they're dosing themselves on their smartphone, and they're sitting with an audiobook in their car and stuff like that. So they're think of them as book omnivores. And in your negotiations with publishers, one of the striking things you can say is that the people who borrow e-books from you are book buyers. They over-index for being a book buyer as well. So it's not like you are taking away market share from them by lending e-books. You are serving this need that this is the book-loving population in all of its form, and they are actually somewhat more likely to be book buyers than people who don't borrow e-books from libraries. So it's just something to know. And there's more reading being done now. There's just we asked this generic question, you know, in recent years since this e-books came online and sort of widespread e-content has come online. Are you reading more? And 30% said yes. If you have a tablet computer, 41% said yes. So the whole reason to get these extra devices now is because people are wanting to live in this, you know, lush media ecosystem. So those are my five great points, but this is the rough one here. So you want to talk about the good stuff? Any other questions? Okay. In our data, every time I say this to librarians, I get vigorous nodding of heads, so don't let me down here. But answer the Marvin Gaye question. Your patrons don't know what's going on in your library. Only a fifth of those that we interview say that they feel like they have a good sense of everything that's going on at this key local anchor institution. 46%, so almost half, say they know some of what's going on. They're not completely oblivious, but they are, you know, they still don't have, they have a sense that there's change underway. So in many respects, you know, the motion and commotion that's visible in your libraries, you know, is processed in their lives, but they still don't have a sense of it. And a third of the population just doesn't have a clue, you know, by their own self-admission. And most times, especially guys, will never say, I don't know anything, when you talk to them on a poll. And on this particular poll, guys were just as likely as anybody else to say, I don't know. So that there's a way that the story of how you've become tech hubs for your communities, and the way that you're having conversations about how do we adjust to this incredibly new environment, and we're all excited about it, you've got to make them more visible, and in some respects, you'd serve yourself well by bringing more outsiders into that conversation so they could go back to their communities and speak up for all the great stuff that you're doing. Yes, there's a question over here. Yeah. We don't ask about whether you're forced to have the device or not. You know, I could imagine, you know, was there a gun to your head when you bought that tablet or when the school system gave it to you? No. So we, what we do have when we talk to 16 and 17-year-olds who are clearly still in high school, they do a lot more of this stuff, and you know, very much it's the case that they're assignments that they're trying to complete and stuff. So a lot of them are readers for enrichment and do lots more reading and stuff, but a lot of it is driven by the rhythms of, you know, their needs for school. So that's for surely part of our data. Yeah. 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 How do you reconcile that? Well, here's one of my answers to that. Those are the people that you ought to consciously cultivate. One of the nice, it's definitely a paradox in the data. And I think there's a sort of aura around libraries that extended from childhood that you're nice, cool, wonderful, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind people. And people, again, sort of like the general notion of where you stand in the community and what you can do. And they probably know somebody who's a pretty active library patron. But there are lots of people who answer, I don't know what's going on, who say, you're important for the community, we love you, we love librarians, and things like that. So as you think about outreach and as you think about your PR problem, one of the great advantages that you have that almost no other institution has is you're going to be talking to people who are already predisposed to think well of you and to pat you on the back and to say good job and things like that. So in our data, 53% of age 16 and older went to a library in the past 12 months. So 47% didn't, right? Okay. So that's the lower left bar here. 53%, you can presume that they have at least a passing knowledge, and most of them will say that they know at least some of what's going on at the library. But then there's a 22-point gap between those who went to the library and those who read a book in the past year. So again, they're already in doing the thing that libraries are intimately connected with. So figuring out who those folks are and maybe cultivating them, telling them your story a little bit more aggressively. There's also a 23-point gap between people who say the library is important to my family but didn't go to the library in the past year. Those are people who are clearly know something's going on in the family that they like, and just, you know, figure out how to tell them how great you are for them as well as for the person that they know. There's a 31-point gap between those who went last year and those who say they've ever gone to the library. And there's a 38% gap between those who have gone last year and who said the library is important for my community. So it's not like you're going to walk into enemy territory as you do your marketing. And I don't mean marketing in the sense of buying ads in the local media. I mean you're networking. You're trying to make sure that people are aware of what you're doing. And it doesn't get everybody you want by having it on your website or having it as brochures at your branches. You have to think more proactively about how do we get our information about who we are, what we do, what we're undergoing into the wider public, in part because you'll get more feedback. The more people you engage about what you're doing and what you're trying to do, the more you'll actually get some useful answers from the people that you're trying to serve. Yeah, right. I hope everybody could hear that because it's just sort of, you know, there are people who are immersed in reading and yet don't know. Only 31% of adults say that they're aware that they can borrow e-books from their local library. And now it's about 94% of libraries offer that as a service. And it's not their problem that they don't know. You know, and it's a challenging environment getting people's attention, you know, penetrating the fog of data that's pouring into their lives. It's not an easy thing now, but you guys would serve yourselves incredibly well just by cultivating your natural allies. It's a library or bookmobile. And there's another about 4 or 5% who all use libraries and bookmobiles but also use the library website. So it's about 59% altogether have had contact in the past 12 months with a library. But 53% is the actual going physically to a place. do we ask people about family use and things like that? Our reports are really rich in what people do at the library. We don't ask beyond the individual respondent, except for we did some special questions in the last survey. You might have seen a report that we did about parents of minor children. And if you want to talk about cultivation, the single most advantageous step you could have in promulgating your message to the wider community is talk to moms of kids who are under age six. You know, a lot of them might even be bloggers. So, you know, there's a multiplier effect of them promoting you on their blogs and things like that. They love you more than anyone else. They talk you up more than anyone else in the community. They think it's incredibly important what you do for the children, and they want to share that with other folks. And so they're in our reports. It's libraries.pewinternet.org or vice versa. Go to pewinternet.org, and you'll see our library special page. All of our reports, which have rich detail about what individuals did at the library last year, a couple of things about what families do in the context of minor children, and lots of demographics. You know, African Americans and Latinos, in many cases, are very different from whites. Older folks are different from young folks. Sometimes men are different from women. Funny thing about that. There's just tons of data on that. Yeah. The work we're doing for Gates is only about public libraries. So the school library community, the academic, the special libraries community and stuff, there's sort of inferential things that they can draw from this, but we don't ask directly about it, in part because, we wanted to get that's what mattered to Gates, among other things, but we also wanted to get the widest public reading on the public institution that they knew. Yeah. When we encounter someone on the phone, do they know right away that we're going to ask them about libraries? No. We ask general questions about how are things going in your community. You want to keep them on the phone. That's job one, because so few people now will do that. And so we ask about community status. We ask about technology use. And then we start asking about library questions. But we don't ever explicitly say, by the way, this is a survey about libraries and how you use libraries and stuff like that. At the end of this survey, just before we hang up, we say this material is going to be used by a foundation, the Pew Internet Project, for a report about libraries. You can look for it so that people can see, you know, they've spent their time with us. We want to make sure that they can see what the fruits of their labors and stuff. Yeah. No, I'm not getting to this because this is a hard question. The issue is libraries have a broad base of support, but if you move in the direction that I was alluding to at the beginning questions towards more of a niche specialized service or what you franchise and that's what you're going to lavish your attention on, isn't that going to erode potentially your wide base? And that's one possible outcome. So one of the ways that lots of institutions try to bring their communities along, communities not only physical communities but communities of interest, is to explain why they're doing what they're doing. And the hard choices they're making or why they think certain new functions and services might be useful. And they ask. I mean, the hallmark of the internet age is that you only have to ask once and you'll get lots of feedback. I'm sure you already get it, right? And they're nice because you're nice, and so it's not nearly as troll-driven as lots of other places. Thinking of it as a collaborative process where the stakeholders as much as the staff are in conversation and contributing to each other's thoughts about this. And it's not a guarantee that you'll win all the hearts and minds that you want on this. But one of the other striking things that we see in our data in other contexts is that trust is shifting in our culture. You know, there's less institutional trust, there's more trust in people in their own networks, right? And one of the ways that people now judge organizations and institutions is how transparent they are. It is a benchmark of trust. So it used to be reliable. You know, it comes from a process that I understand. It's presented to me in a format that I understand. A book would be a classic example. Okay, I'm going to invest trust in this. Nowadays, it's an added thing. Can I contribute to it? Can I comment on it? Can I see what other people have had to say about it? Can I see the institution explaining why it did what it did and some of the choices they made and things like that? That's a new way now that people are sort of calibrating what they want to invest in or not, invest their time in and stuff. No, we don't. There was wonderful work. I don't remember whether they asked this. The OCLC did some work in 2010 They did a wonderful market segmentation of people and support for funding of libraries. Do people remember that? Maybe on the hashtag you can. It's OCLC and it's library. You know, support for financial support for libraries or something like that. They might have asked questions related to that, but we have not asked that. In some respects, I think one of the things that might be going on in the affection for libraries data is they don't necessarily think of you as the government, which is not the, you know, if you remember the Gallup list, the lowest ranking institution was Congress, right? We don't have data on that. I've seen stuff like that. I don't know if 70% is the number I've seen, but you know, there are a substantial portion of people reported by other researchers who essentially don't physically encounter the library or librarians. They order their books online. They walk in, pick it up, check it out with the barcode reader, and really don't identify themselves or stuff like that. It's if it's not 70%, it's probably a major number, particularly of folks who are under a certain age. And so it's, you know, that again, that's an audience that already loves you and already appreciates what you do. It's so finding a way to at least sort of raise your hand and say, by the way, you know, we could do this other thing for you. Or did you know that we're talking about this? And we know you've checked out a lot of books and you know, help us. What would you like us to pick next? I mean, anything that now that has the flavor of a conversation and that you're listening as well as telling is all for the good, because that's the nature of markets these days, is conversations. It's not just sort of smart me telling you what you need to know. It's not a transaction anymore. It's a process. Yeah. That's a nice point. I hope people could hear it. We're asking a question about libraries. Do you know everything that's going on? And we didn't ask it about banks, or we didn't ask about the local high school. And so wouldn't lots of people sort of say, I don't know everything that's going on at those other places. So aren't we sort of highlighting a systemic issue rather than something that's particular to libraries? That's probably true, although people tend to answer questions like that in an instrumental sense. If I'm getting everything that I need from the local bank, I don't care, you know, what passbook accounts that they have that I don't know about. The one batch of questions I can think of where people at similar levels express concern that they don't know everything is with their cell phones. So the damn thing can do much more than I know it can do, and it scares the heck out of me, and it might be spying on me, and I don't know all these trillions of, you know. And so there's some of that going on, but I absolutely, that's a nice point, and I'm overemphasizing the uniqueness of librarians in that point. There are ways that probably people who answer, I know some of the stuff, they're absolutely getting everything that they need from you. They don't need to know the extra stuff. Yeah. Nice. Right. That's a great point. That's a great point, too. This is much more a pull world than a push world. And throughout, I mean, that's exactly the reality of the news business, too. Yep. How many people think everything is online? And a lot of people do think that. And what I hear a lot from librarians is stakeholders think that, or the funders think that. Why do we need to fund libraries anymore if everything is online? Which is partly an answer to those questions. What's the future of search? It's not necessarily finding facts in the first place. It's connecting the dots. It's critical thinking. It's identifying high quality information as opposed to the large amount of dreck that's online and stuff like that. So the curation function and the pointing function, or the portal function, this is good stuff that you can rely on, has been elevated in the library world. From the special library community, I hear a lot that over the past generation, the nature of queries has completely changed. It used to be factoids, right? You know, run down this factoid for me. Everybody now uses search engines for that. What they want is these incredibly complex synthesizing documents that not only are up to the minute in what's known, but give me history and context and things like that. So they're able to answer fewer queries because the degree of difficulty of them has spiked incredibly and will probably only get more intense over time. I just want to show you what I've got, because we ask questions on this, and you'll appreciate that. We asked some questions about what should libraries definitely do as they think about the reallocation of services or the reorientation of services in the future. They wanted you to solve big, knotty problems. They wanted you to fix the school system, and they wanted you to teach literacy. There's a palpable sense now that the nature of literacy is changing and is an additive kind of issue now. They want you guys to fix that problem. They want separate spaces for different services. They want more comfortable spaces. That, again, is underlined. The broader selection of e-books, a majority said they should definitely do it, but it wasn't that huge. And then under a majority, we talked about interactive learning experiences like museums and stuff like that. Anyway, I'm not going to read all these, but the one to highlight, and when we were asking what should libraries definitely do, there was what any political consultant would call a very divided public on the question of, do you get rid of your stacks and your books and make more way for public spaces like tech centers, reading rooms, meeting rooms, and cultural events. Only 20% said libraries should definitely do that. 39% said maybe. 36%, far and away the largest negative vote on any of the things we asked about, said, don't you dare. You know, those are our books. You know, what's going on in the New York library system, what's probably going on in many of your systems. People are very ambivalent about that. And then we asked some personal questions about what if the library provided you this stuff, what would you do? And so we asked about ask a librarian online services, building apps that could help people navigate library resources, but also the library building itself, Redbox type kiosks around town, digital media labs, and things like that. And so that's all in our data, and I've at the back of these slides, which are going to be available here and on our website, pewinternet.org. I amplify some of the things that I'm thinking about as I go through those six questions, because I don't deal with the metered part of the question. And I want to end on a word of comfort and hope. Because this is challenging stuff. You're here today because there are stressors in your life and excitement all at the same time. But I can't, now that I know librarians in a way that I never used to before I began this work, I am very confident that you're talking about the right stuff, that this training you've already got and the things that you already do well will serve you well as you broaden them or change them or adjust to the new realities of them. The instinct of librarians to think hard about the quality of information and the context of information, the ownership of information. Nobody thinks in this world quite like librarians do. I never knew you were privacy radicals until I engaged this world. It's like, whoa, that's SDS on steroids, practically. So I'm comforted as a citizen that you guys are meeting like this. Again, everybody else is talking about it, so don't be afraid as you have these conversations, because you're going to make us a better culture, you're going to make your communities better, and thank you so, so very much for doing that. Thank you.